From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we continue our series of conversations about the way we discuss race in this country. Nagin Farsad is an Iranian-American Muslim who believes maybe laughter is the way to get people together. Farsad calls herself a social justice comedian, and recently she joined us to explain just what it is about a joke that can get us into those really difficult conversations. We'll be right back.
Benjamin Franklin said, "Tell me and I forget. Teach me and I may remember. Involve me and I learn." That sums up KUER's community calendar pretty well. You'll learn new things, like how to make your own honey, or write a story, or arrange flowers. There are new events every week, and if you've got something you want to show people, you can post your own events too. Check out the community calendar under the events tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a story Nagin Farsad tells about coming to Salt Lake City a few years ago. In fact, she wasn't just in Salt Lake. She went to Temple Square and she stood on a corner with a sign that read, "Hug a Muslim." Farsad is an Iranian-American Muslim and a comedian. In fact, she calls herself a social justice comedian. And she was here as part of a tour with some other Muslim comedians. They were filming a documentary. And the idea was to go to some of the really red states and to talk about Islamophobia and stereotypes. She writes about this in her book. She writes that, of course, she knows Mormons have a complicated history with race, but that her encounter on a cold day outside of Temple Square was beautiful. The sign said, "Hug a Muslim," and Nagin says people were standing in line for a chance. Here's how she puts it in her book. "Those Mormons brought with them hugs so tender and warm, so loving and mirthful that it warmed the cockles of my heart." And you have to understand, Nagin's cockles were pretty hard, she said, hard and scarred. Back to the book. "But these Mormons, man, each touch soothed out a piece of scar tissue until my cockles were as smooth as Sofia Vergara's calves." And it's a great story, right? But then, right in the middle of all of this, someone drives by and shouts, "Go back to your own country." And doesn't that perfectly describe the possibilities and the struggles we still face as we figure out how we're supposed to talk about racism in this country? Huffington Post called Nagin Farsad one of the 50 funniest women. Her book is How to Make White People Laugh. She's also the director of the documentary film The Muslims Are Coming and a panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And she's the host of a podcast called Fake the Nation. She joined us last week at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah as we continued our conversation about diversity. This is a partnership with United Way of Salt Lake. We recorded the conversation in the moot courtroom at the law school. Please welcome Nagin Farsad. Have you always been funny?
Oh my God, I was like a mute until I was like 14. Like I didn't really speak. Like I had friends or whatever, but I was shy and afraid. And then I was, I took a drama class. That's always like the beginning of the origin story, right? And then I auditioned for the play and I was cast as not kitchen wench number one or kitchen wench number two, but kitchen wench number three. I think we could all agree the most important kitchen wench in the musical Once Upon a Mattress. And I had a short scene and I got a lot of laughs in this one scene and I remember just feeling like, this is amazing. Like the power washed over me. Like I had like a Mao Zedong moment where I was like, this is great. I can say anything right now and they'll listen because I just made them laugh. And so I was kind of a goner since then.
But you weren't thinking about comedy necessarily back then.
No, because my goal was to be the first Muslim president of the United States. And Barack
wait,
Obama
wait, wait. That's,
beat me
that's
to
no joke,
it.
Right? I mean, that's...
But, He's such a muzz. he's not a muzz. He's not a muzz. Anyway, but no, of course I would say that. He's totally a muzz. But no, I was really into politics and I ended up with a master's degree in public policy and another one in African American studies. Whatever, you need both of those to be a comedian. And and so I was trying to be serious. I interned for Hillary Clinton. I interned for Charlie Rangel. Like, I was trying to be that guy. Anyways, here we are.
Yeah. In your book, you write about this tetherball incident. Wanted to ask you about when you said something kind of raunchy to Shelley Caminelli, and you were 8.
Yeah.
And so I wanted you to tell the story because it seems like that you're only 8, but like there's this attitude that seems to be there, and you seem to learn something from this moment.
Yeah. This is such a stupid story, but like, so I grew up in Palm Springs, California, and which is like a hotbed of senior citizens, and I grew up like in a neighborhood with no children. It was literally me and senior citizens or whatever. So like, there would be Cadillacs driving at minimum speeds down the street, and like, I'd have like 20 minutes to like clean up my toys or whatever, and like go to the side of the road or whatever. As they were like, you know, and so Palm Springs is a really weird place. And I went to, when I was in elementary school, I was really good at tetherball. Like, I'm not trying to brag, but I was really great. And I'm sorry, I know, does that make me just seem like, ugh, such
no,
a snob?
No, I mean, you should be proud if you're good at tetherball.
But, so I was really good at tetherball, and I was waiting for my turn, and this girl who was in my class was a bully, and she, Shelley Caminelli, and she cut right in front of me. And it was just, you know, I was a quiet kid. I let a lot of things, you know, kind of happen to me. And the like bullying like that and stuff. But in this moment, I said something to her, you know, because I said to her, I was just enraged, you know, and a switch had been turned on. I couldn't take it anymore. And this was tetherball after all. And I was the Serena Williams of tetherball, including yelling at umpires apparently. And which she deserved to do. Anyway, so we could talk about that after. I said to her, you know, suck my dick, Shelley Caminelli. And I was 8 years old, right? So, like, I didn't know what a dick was or what sucking had to do with it. But, like, I sort of intuitively knew that it applied to this situation. Of course, like, the one time I had a transgression as an otherwise perfect child with senior citizen best friends, there was a school attendant who heard me say that, and she takes me, you know, to the principal's office, and I'm sentenced to lunch on stage in the cafeteria. Now, I don't know what kind of, like, aberrant elementary schools you guys went to, but in my elementary school, when you were punished, you had to eat lunch in front of everybody. So they would put you on a stage, and then you had to, like, commune with your tater tots in shame in front of the rest of the school. And that's, like, how they punished us. And I remember the first tater tot was difficult, but each additional tater tot was like, this is an act of civil disobedience, you know? And it was like, I was sort of like Henry David Thoreau was like coursing through my veins, obviously. And I was just like, I can handle this shame. Cause it was like hundreds of kids staring at me. I was up there with, like, you know, the guy who picks his nose all the time or whatever. And, you know, it was initially humiliating, but then it was like empowering, you know? And that's when I think I became an activist.
So before you got to Palm Springs, your family lived in, I guess it was rural Virginia, and this was during the Iran hostage crisis. Mm-hmm. You've talked about your brother getting beaten up in school during that time. What were you aware of? Were you fairly young. Were you aware of what was going on? I mean, at what point did you become aware of these racial conflicts?
Well, I was a baby during the Iran hostage crisis, so I didn't know anything about that. But I remember one of my earliest memories is my brother coming home. He's 13 years older than me. So he was coming home from like middle school or high school, and he had been, you know, beaten up. He had like a black eye or whatever. And I remember just being like, that's weird. You know what I mean? Like, okay, violence, whatever. I'm a child. Feeling the distinct reality in my preschool and my kindergarten that I was like the only girl that looked like me, you know what I mean? We had an unusual number of like really beautiful blonde little girls or whatever. I don't know how they even amassed all of them in one place. It was very odd. So it was just like beautiful blonde girls and Nagin and my name was like Nagin, and I'm Iranian, but strangely I spoke like with a redneck southern accent or whatever, because that's how I learned English. So I feel like early on I realized that my parents were not made for Virginia. I mean, they left Virginia because it was too racist for them. If we think to the heydays of 1980s bigotry, people hated Iranians because of the Iran hostage crisis. And so there was a lot of anti-Iranian sentiment. So that's, you know, why my brother would get beaten up or why my parents would get yelled at or whatever. And then at some point, like one of my dad's friends called him and was like, oh my God, like you have to come to Palm Springs. Everyone is old here. They're like constantly having heart attacks. It's amazing. My dad's a doctor. So like that was a great market for him. You know what I mean? So that's what took us out. And then I was just like in Palm Springs longing to be Mexican, because everyone was Mexican. We had, I'd say 60% of my school was Mexican. And that was another, I mean, it was a lot easier because I look Mexican to 90% of Americans. And so that was kind of nice. You know what I mean? I spent those early years really longing to be like, you know, just call me Consuela. But among Mexicans, I didn't pass. So, you know,
you've also said though that, in certain ways you wanted to feel, or you felt black.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because when I, so it started out as Mexican. And then when I went to college, in upstate New York, at Cornell, and, I had never seen so many white people in my entire life. I mean, in Utah, you know what I'm talking about, but, just kidding. I had never seen so many white people as I did at Cornell. And it was just white people as far as the eye can see. And I was like, oh, like, could I pass? Could this be something like maybe I could just blend in or whatever? What does it involve? Like I can wear, you know, performance fleece or whatever and talk about wainscoting. Like it doesn't seem that difficult. So I tried for a second there, but it turns out there was just like far too much like Dave Matthews involved. And so I couldn't get on board. You know what I mean? That was like a bridge too far. But he had like a couple of good songs, but otherwise. That's when like my black formation really began, and I started taking a lot of like, you know, courses in, you know, the canon of black film and that sort of thing. And I started getting involved in like the activism on campus, which had a lot lot to do with racial disparity and like racial segregation on campus. And the entire time I went to graduate school and I get this degree in African American studies, as one does. And it's interesting because like at no point, like this wasn't a Rachel Dolezal situation where I was like, I'm wearing bronzer. You know what I mean? It wasn't that. It was just, I knew I wasn't black. I wasn't trying. But I had no place, an institutional pathway to place my desire to fight against oppression, right? And I was like, well, I'm not black, but like, you know, I'm Muslim, I'm Iranian American, and it's in that struggle is adjacent to the black struggle, so close enough, let's do it, you know. And so that's when I was in grad school and I was very serious about it. And I was just sort of like, where are all the other Iranian Americans here at Columbia? We're in the African American Studies program. Why aren't there so many of us? Because I was the only non-black person in the program. And people were really loving and friendly, but they were also like, don't you have your own, like, people or whatever, you know what I mean? Like, what are you doing here? And I'm like, I can't believe you would say that. I will fight for African American rights whenever and wherever. Like, I have the DVD box set of A Different World in my backpack. Like, I'm about to change my name to Tyler Perry Presents Nagin Farsad. And they were like, yeah, that's weird. And so that's kind of like where I had to like reckon with my own identity as someone who had I was searching for a posse. We're few in number, so that's not always possible. And then I realized that I could just start talking about myself and my family and see what happened.
When did the comedy come? It was in this phase?
Yeah. I mean, I had been doing comedy all during high school, all during college, and in grad school, I paired it with this public policy degree. It was very like where everyone was, you know, there are people there, like the Japanese government would send people to this school to like learn government or whatever. And so everyone was very like serious. And I was serious, you know, in a way. But I was just like, they would be like, let's do a study group or whatever. And I'd be like, that's cute. I've got a set downtown. I've got to go. And so like, I was doing stand up the whole time.
What was the stand up? Like, were you mixing social justice jokes at that time?
It was a transition phase. I think in the early days of comedy for me, it was a lot about me pretending like I was a dude. And I'd be like, yeah, video games. Like, I don't play video games. But, like, I was trying so desperately. I think this is something that female comics go through a lot, where they're trying to, you know, pass as a guy and act like we're the same and there's no difference. And I, you know, and so we sort of adjust our material to that. So I went through that phase. But then I think, you know, what happens in stand up very quickly is that your initial fodder is your family, you know? So if like I was on stage doing my mom's accent, you know, people would come, after the show, people would be like, oh, that's so brave. It's, you know, in this post 9/11 world, like you're doing, you know, jokes about your, you know, political jokes about Iran or whatever. And I was like, I mean, I like literally did a joke about telling my mom I might have an STD. I don't know if that's a political joke about Iran, but there is Iranians in the joke, you know? And so that's, I think, where things got funny, because where it didn't even matter what I was talking about. I was just labeled a political comic because I mentioned anything about my family. Wow. My early days of stand-up are like right before Obama. So this was like everyone's fed up with the wars. Everyone's fed up with George W. Bush's syntax. And, you know, and that's kind of like when I came into it. And really, you know, after grad school, I was a policy advisor for the city of New York. But then after that, I would take any kind of job I could, you know, so I would get a job at like MTV or Comedy Central or whatever. And, you know, and they would be like, I need to have 45 jokes about Justin Bieber's abs on my desk by 1 p.m. or whatever. And, you know, and so I did those jobs. Like I did those jobs and I appreciate the work. But at a certain point, it did feel like soul-suckingly horrible. You know what I mean? And so I needed to be able to do something to be able to like put together my interest in public service, which is I had dedicated so much time to going into public service. So I didn't want to completely leave that, but I was like, how can I do public service without working in a cubicle and being a comedian at the same time? And so that's when I started, you know, doing stuff like The Muslims Are Coming, in various other issues, dealt with various other issues.
Did it make you more funny?
I think... You know, look, it can be much easier to just, you know, write jokes about the Real Housewives or whatever, you know. I mean, I think it made me happier that I was at least like trying to do something make however tiny mark on social change that I could.
I guess I wonder because I'm just trying to get a sense of what the reactions are when you are telling jokes like that. I mean, there's got to be a bit of awkwardness, and it makes me wonder about something you had talked about, comedy being the social lubricant. And I wonder what you mean by that. It made you think that by telling jokes, by being really honest, that can help us talk about this stuff? I mean, is that how you were thinking about
it? Yeah, I mean, I think there's two things that go on with what I do. One, I think, hopefully, is that by telling jokes, people are, like, having a good time, so they're just more willing to listen. It's, again, that, like, Mao Zedong moment that I had in high school where, like, if you can get them to laugh, then they're just going to listen to you the next thing you say, whatever that is, you know, and then you can like sneak stuff in there.
Yeah,
the thing that I love, the thing that's I think undergirding everything is that I love talking to strangers. And I love performing for strangers and I love talking to strangers. And so I launched this boycott bigotry campaign in Charlottesville, Virginia very recently in August. And we, you know, went to Charlottesville. We had put up these, we had bought ad space in newspapers and in billboard trucks and all over town with these ads encouraging people not to go to Trump's properties. And so the ad said stuff like the Trump winery where every bottle has a hint of racism. Or it would say like the Trump hotel where gold rimmed elegance meets xenophobia. And so we put out these ads. We did a show. It was free to the public, you know, with a bunch of comics. And then I interviewed a lot of people, and one of the women I interviewed was a fanatical Trump supporter. Again, I did this video with MoveOn.org. It's available. You can see it. And it's interesting because I think a lot of people's gut reaction, especially now in 2018, is to immediately become angry. You're faced with a Trump supporter, or you're a Trump supporter and you're faced with a liberal, and your immediate reaction is, "I hate you. You're an idiot." You know, If that has ever been my initial reaction, I've learned to suppress it. But that's not my initial reaction. My initial reaction is, oh my God, let's have a chat. I'm so curious how you got here. And how come I didn't get there? And this is so interesting, you know? And so I was talking to this woman who's a diehard Trump fan, and we're in 20 minutes into a chat where I said, you know, by the way, just so you know, I'm Muslim and my parents are from a Muslim banned country. So if anything were to happen to them, their family can't come see them. Everybody, all of my aunts, all of my uncles, everybody is there, and they can't come to the United States to see my parents. How does that make you feel? And she was, you know, she didn't know what to say. And she was just like, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry for you that that's happening. I'm so sorry. I don't know. I'm so sorry. And she must have said it like a dozen times. And that's the kind of moment I'm always searching for, you know, because she hadn't thought about that specifically. She hadn't met a Muslim specifically, right?
So it's about what? Personalizing it.
It's about personalizing it.
It's a story.
It's about giving it a face, you know, giving it an emotion.
Yeah.
The picture of her life flooded into my brain too, because she grew up in among conservatives. She lived in Birmingham, Alabama. She, you know, like she painted a picture of her life that I was like, I understand. If I was exposed to only the things you have been exposed to, I too would be a diehard Trump fan. And can we understand that about each other? You know,
was that woman? You have this in your book, this chapter called The Taxonomy of Haters, where you identify certain hater groups. One is the mission-oriented bigot whose group affiliation gives them cover for hating hater. We can talk about that.
It slides off the tongue.
It sure does.
Yeah.
We can talk about that one later. I'm more interested in the swing hater, where they're on the fence about whether to hate. This is how you put it in the book. They're ideological sluts willing to be persuaded from one camp to another. What was that woman in a swing hater?
I would say, yeah. I mean, I would say she is, because she didn't. I mean, you know, she was so willing to like get brunch with me. You know what I'm saying? And I think that's where what upsets me is that it sounds kind of cheesy to even talk this way now. Like, people are so divided. The notion that you would like get brunch with a Trump person sounds just so quaint in 1950s or whatever. Make America great again. Where I think the juice, the heart of the matter is. And so I would categorize this person as a swing hater, because I think enough brunches and we could move her over. You know what I'm saying? And she could be fiscally conservative forever. I don't care about that. I'm just talking about, let's get rid of the underlying bigotry.
I mean, it seemed to give you a sense, and you say this in the book, that that people can change their minds. Some people can change their minds. I mean, that must make you feel kind of optimistic.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen some radical shifts in people. We've seen, you know, the guy who was one of the biggest proponents of gay conversion therapy, and he had the organization, I think it's called Exodus International, you know, I'm blanking on his name, but he was a huge, I mean, he was like the most outspoken person on gay conversion therapy. And then he shut down the organization. It was like, this doesn't work, and this is not good, you know, and I was wrong. See you later. I mean, that's incredible, to put your entire career, your entire identity into something like that, and then to come out on the other side and be like, I was totally wrong. You know, we've seen that with some family members of the Westboro Baptist Church. You know, their family members that have come out again on the other side, where they're like, that was all wrong. I grew up in it, and I'm sad.
Yeah, what's doing that? Because one of the things you write about, like, what is making that change? One of the things you've said is culture is really powerful. Is it the culture that's shifting? And so maybe part of the answer is, like, and this is where the comedian part makes absolute sense. If you're having to choose between the public policy part and the comedian part, if culture is so powerful, maybe the best thing you can do is do the comedian part. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Luckily, that's what I did.
Yeah.
No, I think, look, if you look at an issue like marriage equality and you think that Will and Grace had nothing to do with us getting to marriage equality, like, you'd be crazy. Of course, Will and Grace. Like, we're, you know, look at, like, my own parents watching that show and being like, oh, we don't like gay people, but, you know what I mean? Like, Willie's so funny. And, like, that's what I'm talking about, where suddenly these characters come into your living room and they're normalized. And one of the enduring, you know, there was a study that showed, like, people might not actually change how they feel about, like homosexuality writ large, but the fact that they see, like, gay marriage, oh, it happens. The fact that it is a norm that it established and it's not hidden, that it becomes, like, so woven into the cultural fabric, makes people comfortable with it, even though they're like, I'm still not into homosexuality or whatever. Like, they're like, they become, the vitriol calms down, right? Mm-hmm. So even if you can't get them to completely change their mind, they get lulled into acceptance because it becomes a norm. And so I think that's something that culture can really help us do, is establish those norms. And so I think that's where comedy has a role. You know, I did this when The Muslims Are Coming came out. There was a poster campaign happening in New York City in the MTA subway system that was very anti-Muslim posters. And it was spearheaded by an anti-Muslim hate group. And the posters were really offensive. They were also, like, poorly designed or whatever, because one thing we learned about Big is it's like they don't know graphic design at all. Like, they're really bad with, like, fonts. I don't know if you've noticed, but, like, if you meet any, like, let them know. And so we were like, you know, The Muslims Are Coming just come out on Netflix, and we thought, okay, what should we do to, you know, why don't we promote the movie, but putting up funny posters about Muslims on the MTA, which sees 5.5 million people a day. It's a big market. So we were like, let's put up our own posters. We'll say funny things and it'll counter these posters and promote the movie. So then we decided to raise the money. That hate group had spent $300,000, but we managed to raise $20,000 in 2 days online, which is the minimum ad buy at the MTA. So that's all we could afford. And we worked with the MTA for several months on every aspect of these posters, like the design, the colors, the font, the word usage. Like, you couldn't use the word poop or penis, which cut out like half of our material. And so we were constantly working with them to deliver a product that they would be comfortable putting up. And finally, they agreed to put them up. And then 2 days after the posters were supposed to go up, I get a call from the MTA's lawyers. Mind you, again, this is the biggest state agency in New York. And they call me and they say, we're not putting your posters up. They're too political. And so we were like, what? Like, if you look at these posters, they said stuff like, one of them said, like, facts about Muslims. Fact, Muslims invented the concept of a hospital. Okay, great. Fact, grown-up Muslims can do more push-ups than baby Muslims. Fantastic. Fact, Muslims invented Justin Timberlake. You know, so, like, and then at this bottom it would say, one of these is definitely true or whatever. In my heart, they're all true. And then, like, another poster said something like, the ugly truth about Muslims, they have great frittata recipes. And so either frittatas were deeply political for the MTA, or the mere mention of Muslims in this setting was considered political. And so we had to sue the MTA. I mean, I don't know if you guys have ever sued a major state agency before. It was like a year and a half long pap smear, gentlemen. And it was kind of something. But at the end, you know, the judge came down on our side and said, like, guys, like, we haven't gotten to that point in our nation's history where just the mere mention of the word Muslim or Islam is political. And so having to fight for First Amendment rights like that was interesting, and it was gratifying because there was a legal component. There was, like, a win. It felt very concrete. But at the same time, people were like, why are you doing this to yourself? Why do you think these posters, like, you think someone's going to read a poster and then change their mind, you know? And no, I'm not a crazy person. I don't think that, but I do think, and this is how I view like how social change happens when it comes to culture, is that like they'll see a poster and they might giggle, and then they'll see something else later and they might have another like giggle, and then you add up a lot of giggles, like, but it has to number in the millions. And then after a certain threshold, that amounts to like a half a degree shift in the cultural attitude. And that's, and I'm just one of the giggles. But if I'm not there, you know, if we all back out of it, it's like it doesn't happen. You know what I mean? So that's kind of how I view the work. It's you're not, I'm not going to, I can't measure my results. But I know that they're a part of a continuum.
That's Nagin Farsad, writer, director, podcast host, and social justice comedian. We recorded the conversation last week at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. This is the second event in our Realities of Diversity speaker series, our partnership with United Way of Salt Lake. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West. So thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're continuing our series of conversations about the way we discuss race in this country, or the reason we don't discuss race in this country. Nagin Farsad is an Iranian-American Muslim who believes maybe laughter is the way to get people together. We recorded a conversation last week at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. This is another event in our Realities of Diversity speaker series, our partnership with United Way of Salt Lake. So what if you're not very funny and you want to resolve the racial divide in this country? What's the essence of comedy that is working, that's shifting the culture, that's changing things? Is it honesty, just not taking yourself so seriously?
I mean,
what is it?
I think like it kind of goes back to what I was saying before. I think it's about human connection, and I think it's about vulnerability. Yeah. I think it's about not having our guards up when we meet people, and I think it's about making an effort to meet people. I mean, I've talked about this a lot of like, how do you meet your neighbors? Do you make an effort to meet your neighbors? When we lived in Palm Springs, like my parents are like, they're immigrants, right? So they're like a touch racist. is anyone in here the child of immigrants? Do you know what I'm talking about? Okay, there's a couple of you. Okay. So, like, I mean, like, they're fun. Like, they'll just be like, oh, Nagin, we have a new accountant. He is Indian. But that is okay because with money, he is like a Jew. And so you're sort of like a double insult compliment. You don't even know what it is. These Jews moved in next door in Palm Springs. I was in college, and they brought over, they moved into the neighborhood, and they brought my parents a rum cake to be like, hi, we're new to the neighborhood or whatever. And my parents like were like floored by this gesture. And the rum cake was like, you know, moist and delicious. And was it baked with the blood of Christian babies? Maybe, you know what I mean? But I love like someone who totally doesn't understand that I'm joking there. But my parents were just completely moved by this. And so they invited them over for tea. Okay. And then the next week they go out to dinner. And then, like, you know, my cut to like a month later, they've had like a bunch of hangouts. My mom's calling me and she's like, did you know that Jewish family is just like Iranian family? And I was like, yeah, lady, every family is like every family. Did you need a rum cake to figure that out? Like, someone tell Mike Pompeo, because maybe that'll work in the Middle East. But, you know, it's this is the essence. This is what people should do. You need to be baking your rum cakes. You know what I mean? In whatever capacity, whatever that means to you, whatever rum cake means to you, that's what you should be doing. We don't really do that anymore. And so it's led to very people being very isolated. It's led to the growth of these fringe ideologies. And we've seen that. We've seen that with violence and with guns and with the alt-right. But if we had not let these people fall through the cracks as neighbors, then I don't know that we would be here right now. And so I think the solution is so alluringly simple.
One of the things you've talked about is that, and I think this happened in Utah and probably a few of the other states you went to in the Muslims Are Coming when you were filming it. When people would talk to you and they would have these really earnest, honest questions, they would say, like, why don't you denounce terrorism? And why do you have to call yourself an Iranian American? Why can't you just call yourself an American? I mean, and you would give them a break on those questions because you found them, what, really honest? And it seemed like you were kind of grateful for those questions.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, in the movie, you see the question, you see maybe my answer or whatever, but you don't see the like 20 minutes of time I put into making them comfortable. Also, we were plying them with pastries, which is a theme that runs through my work. And, you know, we were making things fun. We had little games. We would give out prizes. Like, I mean, we did all sorts of ridiculous things to create an environment that's like, whatever the question is that you would never ask because you would be too afraid that it would lead to Twitter rage, ask me that question, you know? And so then they would come to this, why don't you denounce terrorism? Or what do you think of 9/11 or whatever? And I was grateful for these questions because they're honest questions. They're not malicious questions. They're questions from people who have been exposed to a limited media diet. If you watch Fox News all day long, you're going to have these thoughts about Muslims, right? And if nobody is ever like, hey, watch Animal Planet, like you're just going to get these same, the same thing over and over and over again. It's going to get, and then if your mom's doing it, if your brother's doing it, your friend's doing it, I mean, you're just then surrounded by people who have the same opinions. And so that's why these questions to me are not malicious. They're real, and they've never had the opportunity to ask them from someone who could answer it calmly, you know, and I would answer it. And I feel like, and it's brave to ask those questions, but we've like really created a situation where we don't let anyone ask a question. We just get angry at them, you know, for having the question.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know.
And does it seem like we're more sensitive now?
Yeah.
Like the people where we can't tolerate those questions or we're hysterical about those questions. Have we always been like that?
I mean, it's weird. Like I've been around the internet for so long. I just don't even really know. There was a time where it was kind of like, oh my God, Cheryl had an omelet for breakfast. Like that was the internet, you know what I mean? And those were sort of like the utopian days. And then there, I think a lot of things happened. It's a combination of, you know, the internet change dimensions. We had a black president, and then Beyonce was writing songs about feminism, and everyone got angry. And it was like, then they give Mandy Kaling a show, and it's like, why are there three brown people on television now? we only really needed the one. And like, so I think it's just like we let there's things sort of like strangely escalated all with, you know, socially, culturally, and politically, and then the internet kind of exacerbated that escalation.
You write about trolls, how you handle them in your book. You can get some really nasty stuff. You've also written about these drive-by haters. That was the guy who mentioned, go back to your own country when you were here. What do you do with that?
Well, it's funny, like, so recently I was on MSNBC because I'm the voice of a generation, and I was there, like, whatever, we were talking about our ruler, and after the show, like, someone tweeted at me, at Nagin Farsad is clearly the Jewish nerd on the panel, and like, as a Muslim, like, I got really excited because it felt like an upgrade, you know what I mean? And so I was like, oh no, thank you. But like, actually I'm the Muslim nerd on the panel. And then they responded, I'm sorry, but you're clearly a Jewy McJew face. And I thought, first of all, like, they know what they want, you know, when they want it. That's a train you can't stop, I guess. And then, second of all, I wanted to point out, like, Jewy McJewface is actually an Irish name, you know, but, like, if you really wanted to get me, you would have been like, hey, Bagelface Goldstein dollar sign or whatever. But it's possible that this guy was like an apprentice bigot. He was just like learning, you know what I mean? So he's like, he hadn't gotten there. We've all been there, right? And so I responded to him, you know, because I don't want to escalate. I never want to escalate. So I responded to him with a smiley face emoji, you know, because if there's anything we learn, I think, from the current political climate is that when they go low, we go emoji. And I really believe that, you know, because I'm just like trying to live a better Jewish life. And I think that's how I try and handle trolls. Sometimes they get more, you know, I was being protested. I did a show in, the like outskirts of Seattle, like where they shoot Twilight or whatever. And so yeah, like it was late and these people were protesting me. I guess they thought I was going to convert everybody to Islam, which is oops, hilarious. And so anyway, like, and I was like, guys, like it started to rain because we're like in the Pacific Northwest. And it was like, guys, it's like raining, you know, there's probably shapeshifters going to emerge any minute now. Why don't you come in and watch the show? And then afterwards you could like resume protesting me like right after the show. And they were like, no, thanks, but we might wait in the lobby, whatever. And so, but I thought what was really lovely about that moment was that, of course, they didn't take my olive branch, but I thought it was lovely that they could protest because the First Amendment here is like pretty great. Like it's not confusing and weird like in France where you're like, you have a freedom of speech except for like six random things that you can't say. You know what I mean? It's like we have freedom of speech. We just have it. And that's great. And so they could be there and they could protest a comedian. And if they want to spend their time that way, that's great. And then I also had the right to be like, hey, guys, you want to come see my show? But I also had the right to do a show. And I, you know, and the whole thing was just like this cacophony of rights. And it felt beautiful. And I think that I guess I try and look at these situations in a way that's not about anger, you know?
Yeah. What's this moment we're in right now? How do you describe it? I mean, Jelani Cobb and others have talked about it as being this kind of the counter reaction to the Obama presidency. That's what explained Trump, and maybe that's what explains the moment we're in right now. I wonder if you think you understand the moment we're in, and do you think I mean, do you feel pessimistic or optimistic about the way through it?
You know, I think change is so hard. I moved apartments. I went 8 blocks up the street, still in the same neighborhood, and I cried. You know what I mean? Like, I cried because I was like, but the bodega guy, like, who is a 7-minute walk down the street. And I couldn't handle, like, just the mere change of being up the street floored me. And which is so stupid, right? But I feel like we've all been there, right? Where some small thing changes and you kind of like can't handle it. You know what I mean? Your dry cleaner decides to retire and you're like, my life is over. And I think that is what's happening, but on a 300 million person level, where it's really hard to embrace change. And there's been so much of it. I mean, again, it's been precipitated by the internet. Like, it's been sped up by all of these technological forces. Yeah. I mean, and it's not just, you know, and it's not just that we had a black president. It's that, like, you have to, like, do your orders on an automated machine at half the McDonald's now. And it's horrible, you know? Like, who wants to cry ordering a Big Mac at one of those kiosks? Like, it's hard. That change is hard. And so it's pervasive. It's everywhere. And so I think, like, our collective response to this change, some people love it. Some people are like Marie Kondo and they can, like, throw things away and they're like, great. Like, this is my magical tidying up. But other people are like, no, but I remember how it was. And I think, so this is like, you know, this feels like the last gasps of what was a comfortable place for a type of white supremacy that we had all just kind of grown accustomed to. And you know, these are the last gasps. And this is like them having a conniption fit at the automated kiosk at McDonald's.
That's Nagin Farsad. Her book is How to Make White People Laugh. We recorded the conversation at the S.J. Quinney College of Law last week. The latest event in our Realities of Diversity speaker series, our partnership with the United Way of Salt Lake. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Brian Albers. Our thanks to Bill Krim, to Geraldine Stowe, to Ashley Razan, and the whole United Way team. Thanks also to Chris Monty and the S.J. Quinney College of Law. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.